Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm Nina Xiang in Beijing. I'm very happy today to talk to our guest, Roger Gordon, Professor of Economics at University of California, San Diego. Professor Gordon is also a visiting professor of economics at Chung Kong Graduate School of Business. I'm not sure if I'm saying the name right.
That's correct.
That's
a Cantonese pronunciation.
So, Professor Gordon, you are in Beijing, but you spent most of your time still in San Diego, right?
That's correct.
And tell us a little bit about the projects or research that you have been doing relating to China lately.
One project recently completed was looking at the sources of finance for state and local governments, and then what incentives those created both for local residents and for local governments.
When you say local, that means Chinese.
Chinese.
Okay.
I mean, the sources of revenue here are totally different than you'd see in the United States or in most other countries, with revenue coming from land sales quite heavily, partly from a local value-added tax, which is unusual internationally, and then personal income tax is largely a local tax. That, again, is very unusual across countries.
Before we go into today's program, I'd like to put out a reminder to all of our listeners that we are giving out a tablet computer to one lucky listener. So details of the lucky draw is on our website. Check it out at www.chinamoneypodcast.com. You have some interesting books on how taxation influences economies in emerging countries. One of those books called Taxes and Development, Experiences of India versus China and Lessons for Other Developing Countries. Let's talk about this book first. In a nutshell, tell us a little bit about how taxes influences economic development in developing countries.
What pulled me into thinking about this subject was seeing how the tax structure in China has changed during the reform period. I mean, at the beginning of the reforms, it was quite typical of other poor developing countries relying on tariffs as a major source of revenue, corporate tax, and various excise taxes. In the paper comparing the Chinese tax structure to India, what was striking is that that characterized the Indian tax structure as well. At the beginning of the reforms, not only did they have basically the same division of revenue across these different taxes, but even pretty much the same tax rates.
So that was in the beginning of China's reform, which is late 70s and early 80s. How that has changed 30 years later?
I mean, at this point, China has joined the World Trade Organization. Tariffs have come down dramatically. Taxes are now much less reliant on the manufacturing sector. I mean, the corporate tax rate has fallen dramatically. Excise taxes have been replaced by a value-added tax. And the same changes have occurred in India in about as many years into their reforms as they occurred here in the Chinese reforms. And their value-added tax rate is now very similar to China's. Their corporate rate is similar. And so we've seen the same evolution of the tax structure in two countries that have many similarities but also many differences. Both are responding similarly to economic pressures was striking. And so what are those economic pressures that have led both countries to respond in the same way? I mean, the hypothesis that I explored in both countries, early in the reform process, it was very hard to collect revenue from the service sector, the retail sector, from agriculture. Most of the revenue came from manufacturing.
Why it's so difficult to collect taxes in those sectors? Is it because a lot of transactions are done by cash?
That's a good part of it. Many firms, particularly in India, were in the informal sector. It's hard to monitor their activity because of cash, because they're so small in scale that it's just too costly to try to monitor them. So in India, most of the economy is informal. And so the national government relied almost exclusively on the manufacturing sector for revenue. These are large capital-intensive firms, easy to know that they're there, and given the capital intensity, quite easy to estimate at least their taxable income. And so the government had strong incentives to try to protect their source of revenue from competition from abroad. and even from competition from smaller firms that were harder to monitor and tax. And so both countries protected the large firms in manufacturing from new entrants at the beginning of the reforms. As the entry occurred under the reforms, here these firms were largely taxed by local governments, the township and village enterprises, but even the private firms were easier for local governments to monitor and tax than for the national government. Revenue was now coming more equally from smaller and larger firms, but divided in interesting ways between local and national governments, with the local government collecting taxes from the small firms and the national government from the old state enterprises and eventually larger private firms.
And the current structure also is aimed at protecting the bigger, larger state-owned enterprises.
To a lesser degree. Yes, it still has that, in part because being state-owned, the government gets revenue as an owner as well as getting the tax revenue. And so it gains more from activity in the state sector than from activity in the private sector, but less of a difference than had existed earlier. And for that reason, I think the government is supportive of private activity, but still preferring to see state-owned firms do well than do private firms.
Right. So comparison between India and China, how their respective tax structure evolved along with their economic reform, it seems like there is a set pattern of how tax structure evolves as economic development advances. And both China and India have followed a similar path on that trajectory.
Yes, and similar to what's seen in other countries. Poorer countries generally have the tax structure that India and China had at the beginning of the reforms. China's tax structure is now quite similar to countries with comparable, even higher per capita income.
Such as countries like South Korea or Taiwan?
It's at this point, at the national level, not that different from Korea, Malaysia, in terms of the source of revenue. More of a role for the personal tax in these countries, less for the corporate tax. Corporate rates are lower in these countries, but these are small differences relative to what had been the case.
If we look at the conclusion of your studies on this comparative analysis of India and China, how can we forecast China's tax structures will evolve in the future?
India's reforms are well behind China's. They started 15 years later. So I think that paper was more helpful in forecasting what will happen in India
rather than where China is going.
Where China is going, since I think China becomes a model to think through where India is likely to develop. For China, the dramatic growth here is, I suppose there are precedents. Japan and Korea both had very rapid growth, in Korea in the mid-60s, and so they may be better models here. But I think at the national level, the basic structure is already broadly similar to what we see even in the most developed countries. The ability to collect the revenue is different. So the evasion rates under the value-added tax, under the personal tax, likely are much higher here. In Korea, they're still higher, but closer to what's seen in the most developed countries and changing quickly. And so I think what the changes that can be expected here are more in tax enforcement than in the overall tax structure, at least at the national level. The other change could be the division of revenue between local and national governments, where even now the business tax is going to local governments. You have a conflict of interest between local and national governments, with many of the taxes on small firms going to the local government, taxes on large firms going to the national government, and so each will try to protect, to some degree, its sources of revenue. In most developed countries, revenue is coming equally from all types of firms.
So basically, if you are a small firm in Philadelphia, you pay the state tax, and then you also pay the federal tax.
In equal proportions to what large firms do.
Okay.
So both are paying all levels of government. Both face roughly the same tax rates. And so that conflict of interest between different levels of government can create perverse incentives. with the national government being less concerned with what happens to smaller firms. Agriculture is now untaxed, and so not a source of revenue. And so it creates an incentive to protect and encourage development of the larger firms.
So it sounds like you think the tax revenue division between the central government and the local government is where reforms should be focused on in the future?
Well, some of those reforms have happened. There were dramatic changes in 1994 with much more of the revenue from smaller firms going to the national government. And local governments then shifted to other sources of revenue. They got some of the value-added tax that was introduced then, and they started focusing on land sales to replace the lost revenue from small firms that was going to the national government. And so the conflicts now are much less than they had been. Still there. I think that will likely decrease further as it becomes easier for the national government to monitor and tax the smallest firms. They'll take over from the local government so that their comparable tax rates nationally on firms of in all sectors, services and manufacturing, small and large. I mean, then there's a question currently as well of what will be the source of revenue for local governments if the national government is taking more of the revenue, even more.
And
from small firms.
And the land that's already sold are massive, and there's only so much land you can sell, and there's a limited amount of land that's available for sale in the future. Are you worried about Chinese local government's potential to repay some of the debt?
It's hard even to know how large that debt is. Its ability to repay depends on property values, since the revenue comes from sale of land. It makes the fiscal situation vulnerable to any fall in property values.
But as revenue for local governments from land sales decline, where do you think the lost revenue will be coming from in the future?
Economists don't have a good record of forecasting the future. I mean, the types of taxes used elsewhere for local governments vary by country. Some are entirely financed from the national government, and China has taken one step in that direction by having the national government finance education. It used to be a responsibility entirely of local governments. The outcome was not that good. People were not getting the tuition-free education that the national government hoped to see, and at this point, the national government is financing this. I mean, in most countries, that's the largest single expenditure of local governments. It's already now financed by the national government. And so one direction that China could go is to have the national government provide financing for the remaining types of local expenditures now financed with land sales or the business tax or the personal tax. Another would be, many countries have a local sales tax that exists here in a somewhat different form through the sharing of the value-added tax. I mean, there are peculiarities under a VAT compared with a local sales tax, particularly in the taxation of firms located in more than one place. I mean, the revenue here goes to the parent, to the location where the parent firm is. But I think that an expansion of a sales tax is a plausible direction. That's the major source of revenue for state governments in the U.S. and a major source in Canada and some source of revenue already in China. And so that may become more of a revenue source for local governments.
But then take a step back. Chinese government really don't have a problem in terms of tax revenue because Chinese government's income has been growing at a rate 2 to 3 times higher than that of the growth of the GDP. So the Chinese government has a lot of money already.
Well, that clearly is a major question that country faces. How much of GDP should go to the government, how much is needed, how valuable are the services that would be provided with more revenue. The revenue here as a fraction of GDP is about comparable to what's seen in other countries with similar GDP per capita. Here it's roughly a quarter of GDP. In the U.S. it's about 30%. slightly higher. In many European countries, it's approaching 50%. So there's a wide range of sizes of government looking across countries, and also very different divisions of revenue between national and local. In the U.S., the local government has about half the revenue of the national government. And here, if anything, it might be the reverse. Local governments have more revenue than the national government. The figures for the national government, if anything, look low relative to other countries, and for local governments, maybe high. And so, yes, there's a question of how large the government should be, and also what functions each level of government should serve. Education is, in most countries, a local government function, but now the national government is financing it. Since that is one of the major functions of state and local governments elsewhere, that raises a question about how much revenue local governments need to perform the other functions.
As our target listeners are investors, how friendly is China's tax structure towards foreign investors?
In one very unusual aspect in the past in China was the much lower corporate tax rate faced by foreign firms compared to domestic firms. I think it came with the price that foreign firms were expected to share technology with Chinese firms, often did, and to the great benefit of China. The low tax rate has ended. It's now an equal tax rate. I mean, this was one contrast with India, where foreign firms face a much higher tax rate, but they've not been effective at learning the technology from the foreign firms operating in India. So that was one difference between the countries. I think foreign investors now still face some pressure to share technology, no longer face the favorable tax treatment. But I think China is already doing well in its own research. And so I think that in competing for FDI, it will need to be more accommodating, welcoming firms without the pressure to provide sharing of technology.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor Gordon. It's now our time to play our favorite game, Long Short.
Long, 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 short.
Quantitative easing 3.
Long, I think the U.S. faces some risk of entering a recession. Fiscal policy is not going to be employed. And so monetary policy interventions at this point, I do think, make sense.
Okay.
So long.
Colonel Gaddafi?
But he's basically out of power now and for the benefit of Libya. So I'm short on.
Dominic Strauss-Kahn?
Short.
The U.S. justice system.
Long.
Japanese yen.
Overvalued short.
American banks.
Short.
U.S. property market.
Long.
The federal government's budget.
Short.
Apple Inc.
In spite of Steve Jobs' retirement, long.
A double dip for the U.S. economy.
Unlikely. Short.
Okay. China's military power.
It's growing quickly. Long would be the...
Okay. Bankruptcy for California.
Extremely unlikely. Short.
Great, thank you. Welcome back. We're continuing to talk with Professor Gordon. Before we go into the second segment, a short reminder about our lucky draw. Remember to go to our website, go to our iTunes page, and leave us a comment, and maybe you will win a beautiful free tablet computer. Okay, so Professor Gordon, let's talk about some news that happened this week One of the reports that came out in China this week I find is very interesting. This report says that there are 960,000 people, almost a million people in China, with assets over 10 million RMB. $1 equals about 6.39 RMB at this point, so around 1.5 million US dollars. That's up 9.7% compared with last year, and they are a young group of people with average age of 39. This is interesting because we know that there's a larger and larger group of people that's becoming really wealthy. But one of the dilemmas for this group of people are the limited options for investment. Most of those have been investing their money in the property market. Is there anything that you think the Chinese government is doing right now that's helping to create more channels for China's wealthy people to invest their money?
I'm glad I don't face the choices.
Are you sure?
I mean, if you put your money in the bank, you lose money each year since the interest rate does not compensate for inflation. Putting money in Chinese stocks is a gamble. Putting money in property has done well, but too well. It's hard to think that these prices are sustainable. One real dilemma is whether to allow people to invest abroad. The result would be major movements of funds, but it would also make it easier for foreigners to invest in China. I think that the cross-border investments will in the end be something that the Chinese government will find attractive. Another is that the very low interest rate on bank accounts is an implicit tax on savers, and that interest rate has risen, but I expect will rise further. And restrictions on what banks can pay in interest, I think, will ease. I mean, the U.S. had similar restrictions in the 1960s, regulating bank interest rates, led to the development of money market funds, other non-bank financial institutions that forced a change in policy. I don't know whether that type of institutional innovation will occur here. There are certainly grounds for it, but I think that the problems created by this regulated interest rate are real and that these restrictions will be eased in due course and should be.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic. Last week, China's vice premier visited Hong Kong and announced a range of policy initiatives. One of them was allowing outside investors to invest in China in RMB. So this mostly will impact Hong Kong, as Hong Kong is the center for offshore RMB market. This is another step towards internationalizing China's currency. Are you optimistic that China's policy will bear some fruit in the near future?
That will be a change that will occur gradually over time, not quickly.
So we're talking about 3 to 5 years, not in the next year or two?
I would think 10 years. I mean, I think that the investment through Hong Kong, I mean, yes, it may make it easier for international investors, but I think a lot of the investment is Chinese investors coming through Hong Kong and trying to differentiate between domestic investors rooting their investments through Hong Kong and truly international investors is hard. And so I think these smaller steps aren't likely to have that much effect. But I do think China has a strong economy that is attractive for investors from any place. They've had a stable currency, making holdings of renminbi potentially attractive. The financial uncertainties in Europe and the U.S. are real, and so investors will look for alternatives. They have looked in Switzerland and Australia and Canada and a number of other countries, but China should be in that list as well.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Gordon, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Last reminder, please go to our iTunes page and give us a rating and leave us a comment. It's just going to take 1 minute, but you might win a free tablet computer. So please go there and support us. Thank you, and see you next week.